For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour a libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors we pour a libation, our shapes. Pour a libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve. And at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent. Leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas. Both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time, they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists. The new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation. Those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to our children and those yet to be born. For they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, but they will call your name in all eternity. To our children, we pour libation. Ashe, ashe, asheo.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep, my brothers and sisters, and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. So happy to be with you here this evening, this afternoon, for a wonderful conversation as we deal with the journey of African-American people. So we thank all of you for being with us here this evening. We operate on the timeforanawakening.com radio network, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network system. Our call-in number here is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. So we are calling format, and you can just give us a call. And if you want to ask the question or just give your opinion, we'd love to have you do that. Tonight's program is the type is that type of program. We are going to seek guidance from all of you. And try to answer some troubling questions. And we need to do a think tank analysis. This is the Black Reality Think Tank. And what a think tank does is they bring together our people who care about the subject matter, and then they look at, through critical thinking, what ways can possibly be used to fight for change. And that's what we're going to do here tonight. I know we're only here for 2 hours, so we can't accomplish all of that. But if we keep pecking at it, and we have been doing that here on the Black Reality Think Tank now for about 5 years. We've been looking at subjects and dealing with them and playing them over and over again and talking about the different ideas that are possible. And we want to continue to do that because it has to happen now. So tonight's program is called Enough is Enough. How much more will this we got to do? And so we want to talk a little bit about that tonight. And so thankful for all of you for joining us. I also want to make mention, we are very happy to have been invited on Friday evening of this week to participate in a seminar, workshop, Zoom conference here in Milwaukee. It is being presented by the organization called the Art of Health, and also sponsorship by the African American Women's Center, which is also a organization that has been operating for some while and is being funded by the Helen Bader Philanthropies. And I am going to be the guest presenter, and along with some others that will be talking about the work and the vision and the legacy of the great Carter G. Woodson. And we are going to be addressing the Miseducation of the Negro publication that he did back many, many years ago, almost a century ago. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. So I welcome all of you to join us on that Zoom conference. It is free, and it starts at 7 p.m. Mountain. I'm sorry, 7 p.m. Central and 8 p.m. Eastern. And that's this Friday. And there is a link on the Black Reality Think Tank website, Facebook website page. And you can go there and get that link and be, always be able to join the conversation and talk with us as well. So I want to just remind you of that. Thank you so much for that. So what I do, or as we know, always the routine is to talk about the ancestors and the shoulders of those who we stand on. which is so very important for our work and the vision in which we do. So tonight I'm going to talk about a sister whose name is Catherine Magnolia Johnson. Catherine Magnolia Johnston. She is one of those dynamic pioneers that we don't hear a lot about, but she contributed very, very heavily to the work of our community. She was a political activist. Catherine Magnolia Johnston was born on December the 15th, 1878, in Dark County, Ohio. She was a daughter of Walter and Lucinda Jane McCowan Johnson. Catherine Johnson graduated at the top of her high school class in New Paris, Ohio in 1895 and worked as a teacher in both Ohio and Indiana between 1898 and 1901. In 1902, she graduated from Wilberforce University with a bachelor's degree and a teaching certificate. She taught at the State Normal School for Negroes in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, from 1904 to 1905, before spending a year as the Dean of Women at Shorter College, which is a predominantly black institution in Little Rock, Arkansas, which was also the site of a bloody racial riot during Johnson's tenure. Working as a Kansas City high school teacher in 1910, Ms. Johnson became one of the first members of the newly formed National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, started in 1909. She left teaching to serve as sales representative for the national NAACP's journal magazine called The Crisis, which was published by the great W.B. Du Bois. After 3 years, Johnson became a branch organizer, helping to establish dozens of branches of the NAACP throughout the South. Johnson excelled, and the organization grew rapidly in the regions that had the majority of African Americans. But despite her success, she began to openly criticize the fact that whites had virtually all of the leadership roles within the NAACP. So Ms. Johnson was let go by the NAACP in 1916 because of her consistent complaints of why were the whites in the leadership position of an organization for African people. And although it is not clear whether the reason was for totally for the criticism of white roles, nevertheless, they did let her go. Ms. Johnson subsequently took a position with the Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA, started in 1844, where she worked among African Americans. Ms. Johnson and her co-worker, Addie Waits Hunton, 1875-1943, were sent by the YMCA to France during World War I to observe the treatment of black soldiers in segregated U.S. Army units. Johnson and Hunton returned home to publish a detailed account of their trip in their book called Two Colored Women with the American Expeditionary Forces 1920. Their accounts is the most detailed description of the cultural climate in France toward African Americans. It has also highlighted the ill treatment of African Americans during the war. It has always been often said a lot of times that a lot of our black musicians and writers would go to France because they thought France was better and that there was no racism there and that they would be able to have more opportunities. That was not true. France was just a continuation of the American soil. After returning to the U.S. in 1919, Ms. Johnson joined the campaign to spread African-American literature throughout the country with none other than the great Carter G. Woodson and the organization called the Association for the Study of Negro Life and Literature in 1915. She did this in Chicago. She was selling a package of works by black authors, and it was called The Two foot shelf, the 2 foot shelf that included 15 books published by the Association of Woodson's organization. By 1928, Ms. Johnson had traveled more than 9,000 miles and sold 15,000 books. A 1950 issue of the Crisis magazine lists Mrs. Johnson, then at the time at the age of 72, as living at the Ezella Mathias Carter Home for Colored Working Women in Chicago. Catherine Magnolia Johnson died 5 years later. All right, those are the kind of pioneers that we can be very responsible in helping us to understand how we were able to do some of the things we did and how things worked out in a way for us. She worked very diligently with Carter Woodson, and Woodson had a lot of folks. One of the things that we're going to bring out in our discussion on Friday, they would go door to door, knocking on the door, selling publications on the history of black people in America. And they were doing that around the 1920s and the 1930s. Okay, so that is Catherine Johnson, Catherine Magnolia Johnson, powerful figure. Okay, tonight, my brothers and sisters, as I said to you, we're going to talk about enough is enough. How many more black people got to get killed? How many more, as the song of the last poet sang, how many more bullets have to be used before we just say, that's enough? No more. No more bullets. Police are killing black men and women daily. Black folks are killing black men and women daily. When does it stop? And the question is, who must stop it? When does it stop? And who must stop it? And so I wanted to thought maybe tonight that we would community think tank that question. In order to arrive, if possible, at a workable solution. And so tonight, all of you are here to join me as we discuss that. You know, one of the things that I have been noticing, and I'm sure you notice the same, particularly during this month where you see a lot of highlighting of black history. You look at the recent film that is airing on Fred Hampton, the brother of the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, and the crisis that he encountered when the Chicago Police Department decided to assassinate him and his family and his children, if they could have, and why they did that and what they were doing, and the fact that there was a traitor that turned them in. We just recently heard... Brothers and sisters, if you're on the phone, could you please mute your mics? I'd greatly appreciate it, because sometimes you can, it does create some disturbance. Let me just do that. Okay. Yes, the Panthers were fighting for the same thing that we're going to talk about tonight, fighting about policemen killing black people in the streets of America. That's what we are here to discuss. And it doesn't start there. You can keep going back even into the age of the Civil Rights Movement. And what were the police doing? Beating and killing black people. And go back further than that. We had this astronomical amount of lynchings that were occurring throughout America. There was just total disrespect for black life. You didn't have the right to have a black life. And if we necessary, we can take that from you at any moment. And actually, we've talked about this before. That goes all the way back to the beginning of 1619 when we landed here in colonial America. And our ancestors, they would encounter that kind of fight. And I guess in a analytical, critical thinking way, I mean, the questions of how, why did that happen, why didn't you stop it then, what was the reasoning behind it, and that's history. That's the history and what we have to talk. But the understanding the factor that history has always of African people been written by Europeans, and so we don't have a good picture of what that's like, and it was because of people like Carter-Witts and others that were, we would begin to have a better image of how that took place. We were given mythology, and mythology that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and Civil War was fought to end slavery, and Thomas Jefferson was a great American who framed the Document of Independence, you know, and all of that cockypox stuff that you hear and that we have been taught throughout history. And if it had not been for the likes of a Carter G. Woodson, you know, that kind of story would have continued on. And so as we now try to address the stories that, and the images and the things that are going on in our community now, and how that we must end that, how do we stop that? How do you bring that to a halt? How do you stop young 16, 17, 15-year-old young men and women from killing each other? How do you stop 14, 15-year-old girls from being out in the middle of the street fighting like cats and dogs? How do you stop that? What do you do? Where does it begin? And, I mean, I know we've got some answers. Well, it begins at home. Okay, well, all right. But still, it's going on. How do we intercede into that process? How do we begin to heal? And there have been lots of answers. And as I said, tonight we just want to kind of hash through some of that again and see where that might happen. The Panthers decided to defend the community against that kind of stuff. The Nation of Islam attempted to do that. They created a group. We had on our Thursday night program called Melanin Live, we had Brother Dennis Muhammad, who got together a group of men and brothers and would go through the streets and sort of put these young brothers in check, you know, talk to them and interact with them. They went to the barbershops and they did some things and they attempted to intercede again into that type of violence. Did it work? Well, it's not finished yet. Of course it hasn't, because we're still getting a lot of killings and shootings. I had one of my friends today that texted me when he saw what the program was going to be, and he said, you can't stop that. It's going to keep on. I refuse to believe that that is the case, that we can't stop that. And so that's what I wanted to talk tonight with you all about. We've done all kinds of studies. The system has done all kinds of studies on us. And, I mean, obviously they were negative, false images, did everything that was humanly possible to degrade the African family and individuals. As I look back in history, some of the stuff that was written, things like the Negro Project by Margaret Sanger back in 1939, and then around in the 40s where Harry Truman hired this Swedish sociologist by the name of Gunnar Myrdal to do a study on black folk, and he wrote a book called American Dilemma. And then later on in the 60s, the New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan did one on the Negro family. And then in the 90s, getting ready to go into the next century, Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray did a study, wrote a book on the bell curve. And so obviously we know that the answer to these questions cannot come from them. It has to come from us. It has to come from our community. In the early years right after captivity and enslavement of African people, that was a major political question. Again, we've talked about that here on here, but I just want to bring that in so that we can bring that into the conversation. That was a question after the 13th Amendment was ratified and the 14th Amendment was signed and the 15th was signed and the 13th. That was something that was continuing to go around called the Negro Question. And the Negro Question was a whole idea of what do we do with the Negro? What do we do with the Negro? First of all, they asked the question, who is the Negro? Who is the Negro? What is the Negro? And what do we do with it? And that was a question that was used in a lot of issues and in a lot of opportunities around that was a question that was done along a lot of studies, a lot of passing of legislation. Thomas Carlyle was one of the writers that talked about that. John Stuart Mills, Einstein, Thomas Watson, IBM, the computer system, Leon Trotsky, the Russian diplomat, and even our own C.L.R. James was one that took attack at who is the Negro. And it was from that a system was created to work with us. And people attempted to answer it, and they answered it in two ways. There was a social answer, and then there was the scientific answer. The scientific answer was, let's rebreed them. Let's mix the bloodline. Let's do some ethnic cleansing and put a better bloodline into their system, and they would then at that point be able to act more civil, and that they'll be more palatable in terms of living among Europeans. Now, and what I'm saying, this is not just me. This is written material that was proposed, and that was the whole Margaret Sanger program. But that she wasn't the first one. This started many, many years before. Back in the 1600s, they were looking at the idea of breeding and looking at that bloodline system. And then the other scientific answer that came back: exterminate them. Let's kill them. We know they have no use for them anymore. We're getting into technology. We're going into the Industrial Revolution. Things are going to grow. We don't need that labor anymore. We don't need them. And then that was troubling conflict. And so that was rebelled to some extent, but to some other extent, it was carried out. There were acts of extermination carried out to get rid of the African bloodline. And then one of the other ones, obviously from there, would be a better system of birth control. Is cut down the population and find a system to control the birth rate. And there were several things. And all of this is written. All of this is just not written. All of it is written. So that was the scientific answer to the Negro question. And then the social answer to the Negro question was paternalism. We're going to have to be their parents, and we're going to have to teach them our way, and we'll construct educational systems and training schools, and we'll teach them how to make beds and empty bedpans, and we'll teach them how to build houses and give shoes, and we'll give money to their own people to do that. So the whole paternalism process was the answer. And then the other one was just right out training. Let's give them some skills that they can use and that will also be able to use by us, that we can use them for doing that. Well, all of this created one thing. It created miseducation. And as a result of that, 2021, we are still dealing with those situations. The system has no use for black males who don't have the ability to provide, you know, skills for the building of this system or participate in this system and the cheap labor. And so as a result of that, they created the prison industrial complex. And so we'll just ship you out and we'll use it in that way. And in some cases, that system is being used to make young men work within the system of things. A lot of these prison programs, that's what they do. They are designed to be created in ways to make a low working class where you never will be able to get above that and raise a family or take care of your children. One of the European academics who's Noam Chomsky, I know all of you know, he wrote something very clearly that's exactly what's in place. He said the United States is unusual among the industrial democracies in the rigidity of the system of ideological control, indoctrination, we might say, exercised through the mass media. So television, radio, newspapers, and now today, Twitter, Facebook, and all those other systems are now being used to continue to control. He went on to say that all over the place, from the popular culture to the propaganda system, there is constant pressure to make people feel that they are helpless, that the only role they can have is to ratify decisions and to consume. That's it. And that's what we are looking at today. And this is the background that has going to have to be considered as we talk about controlling our community, controlling our environment. And you must understand, as you know, I'm preaching to the choir, you know the deal. When any time that you declare that and that you're going to work to your community, you become an enemy to the system immediately. And so when the Panthers and the Nation of Islam and other organizations who took those strong, dominant roles and what they were going to do for the system, immediately they became targets. J. Edgar Hoover said the Black Panthers were the most dangerous organization in the history of America, and they personally declared war against the Panthers over the very same things that we have today: poor education, hunger among families, lack of protection of the street. You can't send your daughters to the store. They may be snapped up, and next thing you know, they're in the sex trade business. What is that? The same thing happened back in the early years. And a lot of this hadn't really been told in detail. A lot of our children were snatched up in those out there in those Mississippi, Alabama farmlands. People would ride through there and see folks out in the yard working, go up to them and do some things, and kidnap them. You heard the story of the two brothers that were kidnapped and put into the circus because they were albino twins, and they were snatched up and made jokes out of. There have been young girls that were made to go. When the Barnum and Bailey circus system was happening, they were always looking for what they considered freak acts and people with unusual, and they would be taken in and done like this. That's the same system that we're fighting right now. We're still fighting young women, young girls that are being found in Las Vegas in the sex traffic business or in pornography business. And so enough is enough. How do we stop it? What are we going to do? How are we going to organize as a community? Are we just going to continue to sit and look at it, talk about it, but do nothing? Are our grandkids going to be dealing with this 50 years from now, 25 years from now? How are we going to address this? This is really some critical things that we have to say. We cannot appear on the system. A lot of you can't write grants. It's like being in a war fighting somebody, and you run out of bullets, and you cross over and tell the enemy, hey, can you give me some of your bullets so I can finish shooting you? How's that going to work? You know, and that's what we do sometimes when we try to tap into the system to do things. We have to do these ourselves. And we somehow or the other, that's not sinking in. And so in any analysis of how to resolve some of these issues, we have to take that in account. You've got sellouts. You've got people that are going to snitch on you, that look like you, and act like you, and walk with you. They are going to put your stuff in the street and tell it and do things behind you just like they did Fred Hampton. That is not true. They've done it in every Black organization. They did it in King. They did it, and he was doing something totally different. He was trying to integrate with white people. And he had people presenting, telling, and snitching, and going behind. So what do we do? How do you stop that? What are examples of history? As I look at the South African rebellion and revolution, it was the same thing. The ANC had much trouble with infiltrators. When Nelson Mandela got out of prison, he talked about it. They had to get rid of the snitches. And Wendy Mandela had to do that, and to the point, in some cases, you had to assassinate them. and there was problems about that and whether or not that should be a tactic or not. But how do you, if not, then how do you get rid of them? How do you know who's a snitch and who's not? How do you know who's going to come into your organization and work with you and steal all the money and do some of the things that we did? Garvey was plagued with that. The Garvey movement was strong, and he had a major problem with snitches and people taking information back, you know, and doing things. And then you had that internal fight that goes on in black work class. We have a class structure problem. There's some people that we won't work with because they're not of the same class you are, or they're not light-skinned like you, or dark-skinned, whatever the case may be. And we fight about that. And there are other divisional messages that are the same way. The LGBT community and some of the issues that are involving around that are serious problems in terms of fighting and change. So what I'm talking about is, how do we fight this battle? How do we fight this war? We are at war. We've been at war for over 400 years. And really, it's not even war, because if you war, you fight back. And you come up with strategies to ward off our enemy and eventually hope to get out. And, you know, as I look around the world, and you look around the world at differences and strategies that other people use and other nations use with each other, nobody does it the way the African-American community does it here. Africa, to some extent, but there's still some issues there because most of theirs is done tribally. They have tribal clashes. And it's, a lot of times it's instigated by outsiders. The outsiders don't do it, but they instigate it from the inside. And they do that. And so tonight I'm going to open up the lines and let's see what we can talk about and see what we can do. I ask you for your input. And this is what we're trying to do. Enough is enough. How do we stop police and black men from killing women and men in the streets of America? How do you do that? What is the process that you do that? And if you think that you can't do anything, you do nothing. You know, just then say that. You know, I just need to see if we can put on the table something that is workable, something that can respond to that catastrophic issue. And we saw what the Panthers did. We know what what that brought up about. Are we willing to go through that type of strategy? Are we willing to deal with that? So let me go over to some folk. Let me bring you back on and let's see what we can do. Brother Herbie, you there?
Yes, good evening, Dr. Rogers. How you doing?
All right, good evening to you, my brother. How you feel?
I'm doing pretty well.
Good. Brother Herbie, how we stop this? Isn't enough enough? Don't you think we ain't had enough?
Yes, I most certainly do. But the first thing you have to do is identify the problem.
Okay.
And the problem is white supremacy is really white inferiority expressing itself through violence and aggression.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at how pervasive it is in North America and South America and Central America, you have around 22 countries in all of the Americas.
Right.
In all those 22 countries, people either speak English, French, or Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
None of that native tongues.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about two continents and Central America that was colonized and is still colonized if you're still speaking that language.
Mm-hmm.
You're still starting out behind the eight ball. And you can't express yourself living under somebody else's yoke. So every individual is born to create and to produce. And when that creativity and production is stifled, that energy got to express itself some kind of way. And it's going to express itself in some kind of negative way.
Right.
I thought about something. I don't know when you was in New York, Dr. Rogers, but in the late 50s, the 50s and the early 60s, when you had the street gangs.
Mm-hmm.
I know Sister Benicia probably knows something about this. The street gang, the chaplains and Corsair Lords and bishops and El Quintos and all of that.
Right, right.
Fighting each other. Now, the gang, each gang was comprised of the same people.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't light skin, dark skin. It wasn't bougie and, you know, wealthy and poor. It wasn't educated and uneducated. It wasn't Christian and Muslim. It was everybody was the same. You just a neighborhood away. Y'all was all Christians. Y'all was all poor. Y'all was all black. But you were beating each other up and hurting each other.
Right. Sure did.
For what? How did that come about when you had a whole city that engaged in this?
Yep.
Of young black men terrorizing other young black men that was in the same predicament they was in.
That's right. Yeah, I was there in the 60s. I was there in the 60s.
Yourself.
Yep.
And because of the energy that you have no other way to express it.
Right.
Any creativity, any talent, anything that you want to be, you had no way to do that.
Exactly.
So it expressed itself in anger and violence.
And that's a good example.
So what we need to understand is when you look at the all-black towns and the Tulsas and all these other kind of places, it was where black people had the ability to create and express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But once that's stifled, then you're going to start having a whole lot of problems. When you go to school, you don't go to school to learn how to think. You go to school to listen to what you're told and to repeat it and nothing else.
That's it.
And if you have another idea, you're considered disruptive. And they'll put you in a special class.
Mm-hmm. And that's the history. That's that history of the development of that. And to a point that even I have, through time, have even questioned a lot of our ancestors who were participating in that, get your education, go get this, go get that. There was some other stuff that was needed to go along with that, that we that somehow or the other just wasn't there. And I know that we were coming fresh out of captivity, out of the captivity system. The captivity system was still lingering around in the 40s, in the 30s, in the 50s. And I mean, in terms of when I say lingering around, I mean it's direct action from that. So you still had plantations being worked down in those cotton belts and tobacco belts. I recall that, even in Durham, there were. I don't, you remember. Black folks used to, early in the morning, about 5:30, 6 o'clock, you go downtown Durham at Five Points, and a whole bunch of black women be standing out there to catch these buses to go out to Hope Valley and some of those white areas to white out there by Duke University and go out in those areas to go work in white folks' kitchens and so forth. And mm-hmm. that history, we didn't break that chain. That chain didn't get broken in some way. So I agree with you, Brother White. So let me ask this. So the white supremacy system that you say that has that chokehold, do you see anything that we can begin? And I'm not, you know, obviously if we do it, you got to be talked about in a different way. But is there possibilities to disrupt that? And we don't have to talk about what it is, but it just is there possibilities that you see?
yes, if we can capture the mind of our children at a very young age to let them know that there's that even though you're sick, there's nothing wrong with you.
Right.
The sickness that you're dealing with was created by something else, because there's something wrong with each and every one of us. We don't live normal lives.
Right.
We don't think normal. We don't act normal. It's sort of like if I went to your house right now and took two cobra snakes and let them loose in your house. You don't know where they are. They're somewhere hiding. You're scared to go home. When you're at home, you're terrified all the time. You don't know when something is going to happen, when one of them snakes are going to bite you. You're scared to go to bed. When you get in the bed, you lock the door. You're scared to go outside that door in the morning.
That's right.
That's what we're dealing with every day, with the threat of what white supremacy and whatnot can do to us on a daily basis.
That's right. Exactly.
We don't deal with it. Some of us deal with it because we used to it, but subconsciously, you know what can happen to you on any given day, on any given situation, in any encounter with a white person. If the police come, you know whose side they're going to take. You cannot even defend yourself.
Exactly.
Just to mention one thing. But this is what African people deal with every day. So everybody's messed up.
Mm-hmm.
We just function with being messed up. And sometimes some people function better than other people, and some people don't function at all.
And you're right. And you mentioned before, a lot of our young folk got that energy. They're not afraid of everything. They're not scared of everything. They're willing to fight. But the problem is they don't know how to direct it in the correct way. And I think all of us have had that experience. We had energy. I remember when during the civil rights boycott, I wanted to fight white boys. You know, I wish one of them would have said something to me. I wanted to fight them. They throw something in, throw it back at them. You know, you had that kind of energy. I wasn't afraid of them. I wasn't afraid to run from them. But again,
if you have some type of talent, how do you express that talent? Where do you go? You don't have no place to go.
Right, we don't.
You can do something that you know, that you see other people doing, that's getting paid for, and you can do it, but there's no place for you to actually express it. So every day you wake up with no sense of hope or anything is gonna go well that day.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Every way you turn, something negative is happening.
That's right. There's a European political scientist that wrote a book called Two Nations. His name is Andrew Hacker. And you might have heard of him or read the book. But one of the things that Hacker said, he went further with his study, and he said that white men basically are afraid that blacks are going to retaliate from the system of captivity, and that any moment there will be a possibility that that will be some kind of an uprising. And he interviewed leadership European Americans. He interviewed them and asked them that question. And he said 99% of the answer was that they did think blacks would eventually, at some point, rise up to fight back from the years of captivity. And so as a result of that, a lot of legislation and a lot of policy was divined and developed to speak to that. The FBI's aggression on organizations that were aggressive and were willing to to take them out, like the Panthers. So they came at them like, they don't come at the Russians harder than they came at them. But those are things that you see that very clearly indicate that, there are some challenges that we need to consider, as you're talking about this plan, what the plan might be. and how that what the plan might
how,
look
how
like.
Many things do you see on television on a daily basis that you know they're not including you in it?
Oh, lots. Everything. Lots.
Yeah. So how do you feel? So psychologically, how do you feel when you're seeing all these, when people are seeing, younger people are seeing all these things and they know they're not being included in it?
Exactly. Exactly.
Like I said once before, if you take little children in school and every day you give everybody a cookie, two cookies and some milk, but you don't give little Johnny no cookie and no milk. You just don't get none. Don't tell him why. You just don't get none. Every day them kids get their cookies and milk, everybody but Johnny. Sooner or later, Johnny's going to hurt somebody.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sooner or later, he's going to hurt somebody.
And, you know, one of the other things that I think about a lot, too, as well, and I want to go to another call after this, two of the most powerful propaganda machines that operate in America is motion pictures and television. And they are used to program people. They've always have been. And over time, the way Hollywood plays out the production and creation of these images that they show is interesting. That was the period where we were always fighting Indians. And that was you would always be assured that the cavalry or the cowboys would beat the Indians and the Indians would be killed. And then it went from the Indians to the Arabs. And then, in all of the conflicts, you would always be assured that the enemy was going to win. The movie that we just is out now on the Black Panthers, it tells a story that happened, but it was also portraying an image of look what's going to happen to you if you try to fight back against the system. It throws that fear into the game a little bit. And all movies, even those fictitious ones. I've watched that one, Queen and Slim. And,
yeah.
You were rooting for them to get away. But I knew very clearly they were not going to get away. They would never allow that message to go out that they were able to escape from killing a police officer. You know, and so those kinds of things, you'd be surprised they're subtle, but they play very heavily into our psyche. And
most movies with black people in them, there's never a black hero.
Never a black hero. Never. You know.
Always a black victim.
That's right. And that's a part of that programming system. Let me go up here to my brother. I think this is Brother Horace. Brother Horace Kraft, is that you?
Yes, sir. Yes,
okay.
Sir.
Well, Brother
Doc Rogers, thank you.
Thank you. Brother Kraft was a police officer, and he was... he has been doing one of our radio programs on Saturday that deals with the elders, and he's been bringing on police officers on the program to talk about that and to talk about the mind from the police officers. There are a lot of them are African-American police officers that he's brought on, but they're talking about the killings and things that are going on in the streets, and even some of the police officers that are doing the killing of blacks as well, too. We know very one situation here in Milwaukee. So, Brother Horace, let me ask you something. I remember from my days in New York Police Department, there are certain characteristics that most police officers have. First of all, they're gun lovers.
Yes.
All of them collect guns. They've got walls full of rifles and pistols. Mm-hmm. And they talk about them all day. They bring gun books to work, and they sit around looking at the different guns, and they take their some of their off-duty revolvers, and they put pearl handles on them, and all that. They just into that stuff. It's a killer psychology, and I think about that in relationship to something I had heard years ago, that Paris Island in South Carolina, which is the Marine training base, and the one in San Diego, which is Marine training base, when they send the soldiers out into those wooded areas for training, there are signs all around that say, kill, kill, kill. So as they're going through their training tactics, they see these signs and these things are programming. They're programming. So let me ask you, do you think that, because first of all, a lot of the police officers that are hired come from out of the military. That's one of the great requirements, is to hire somebody that was in the military. Do you think that programming is what's driving a lot of this killing, or is it just plain race? How do you see that?
I think it's more just race, because there's a lot of military people that are in the police department, but you can't put the numbers higher being on the ones from the military that are doing the killings on the black people,
right,
or the non-military. The attitude is that black people just don't have any value. And the system has always promoted that from cops being the slave catchers. Well, they weren't necessarily cops back then. They were just people that were hired to, you know, get the slaves back, you know, after they had freed us, you know, in the late 1800s. So, I mean, that's just the mentality and the training.
Yeah. Now, and there's no way to combat that, is it? Is there a way that can be combated, do you think? If he's programmed to kill.
You know, fighting back is basically the only thing that you can do. That's what I believe. Because the police, when the Black Panthers armed themselves, they weren't necessarily having shootouts with them. Not when they knew that they could shoot back at them. They had to maintain some type of advantage. And that advantage was like what you talked about earlier. They had to find somebody to infiltrate them and give information out, you know, so that they could gain some kind of advantage and talk them into giving them this information, and then they get in there and they end up killing everybody when they indicated that they weren't necessarily going to do that. But we just have so much hatred out there and misinformation. And the biggest misinformation is our history. Because we don't have the history, and because we also have that plantation mentality, like some of the officers. Mm-hmm. A lot of the officers, they go along just to get along. They know that they're wrong. And how good can another police officer be to watch somebody else brutalize somebody? We just had a killing of a young man in New York that was mentally ill. They put a bag over his head, a spit bag, a Darnell Perdue. This was in March 30th of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed the video of that. And so you had nothing but white police officers, and you had a black male. And he was had a mental illness episode, and he was naked on the streets.
Mm.
They handcuffed him.
Mm-hmm.
They put a hood over his head.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of them kneeled on the side of his head.
Oh, yep.
And he died several days later, and they ruled that as a homicide. And they tried to prosecute the police officers, and they did not want to. They said that they ruled that that was fine.
Okay, now I've heard you say in a couple of those broadcasts that you did, you would say that there's a rule, there's an underlining rule that police officers have, that that the authorities have, you know, the authoritative system, the captains and police chiefs, not to come back on officers in hardcore ways. Tell us about some of that.
Well, you know, one of the things that they talk about all the time, and I was just at on the we call it the Council of Floyd. They have where we spoke with the acting chief for Milwaukee. This was maybe about a month and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that went on there in that meeting They talk about, you know, how we need to get together and talk about things, and people need to understand what the police officer's job is really like. And one thing that police officers, they stick together and they do, even the black officers, they will not tell the truth about what happens.
Mm-hmm.
They will always make it seem like your eyes just don't really know the truth. And the only truth that you get is what comes from the police. And that sticks most of the time. And when you look at a lot of these TV shows like FBI Files or 48 Hours.
Cops, you know, and all that stuff, Cops.
Black people.
Yeah.
Or they show FBI capturing these white people that were serial killers. And, you know, but these are incidents from 30 years ago. But they show how diligent these officers were. So you make them look like good guys. So the general public sees these officers and they see this, these shows, and they're like, oh, wow, these guys do good work. So they can't understand what's going on wrong, because when they show black people, they show them drug dealers and stuff like that, or murderers like they do on 48 Hours, gang members, things of that nature. They don't show those situations where a Trayvon Martin or Joseph Blake, well, he wasn't killed, but he was shot. But they don't show a lot of those situations where these officers made these egregious mistakes. They don't do that. You won't see Sandra Bland, that situation. You won't see those situations.
Mm-hmm.
And that is part of the strategy, and they keep us hating each other. I mean, that's all part of the Willie Lynch letter, you know, because right now, as long as we hate each other and we fear each other, we're not, it's divide and conquer.
Right.
And so right now, you don't, I mean, I have other police officers that they don't want to live in a black neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They want to live in a white neighborhood, but they want to live among, and they're very comfortable with that, as long as they wear that uniform, because
gotcha.
They feel that, you know, go along to get along. And since they know me and I'm one of them. And so we have so much of that going on. And until we get more people to understand who we really are, knowing our history, and that's a difficult thing, because we came up loving and worshiping our oppressors. We're Thomas Jefferson,
sure did.
A rapist, pedophile. Are you kidding me? But so we talk about all those different things and those different people about how great this country is. And, you know, I was just reading about some of the women, the lynchings and so forth. That they did 188 lynchings from 1848 to 1969.
Mm-hmm.
Just as far as women, rape, molested.
Yeah,
6 years old, 15 years. I mean, we can go back to the early 1900s where using our babies as baits for alligators and so forth. But, you know, these are the most evil people on the planet. But yet they're trying to get us to use them, I mean, to negotiate with them for our salvation.
Right. And see, that's the question we've got to deal with. You've got to dissolve that question on how to do that. You know, I mean, we just talking about it, you know, and so that's one of the reasons that I wanted to begin that. Well, not begin it, because we've been doing it for a while, but to really ask that hard question, you know, how do you fight that? You know, because you got to fight it, because they're not going to stop on their own. You can't go to them and expect them to change because you don't like it.
But, you know, like the caller was saying earlier, and he made a comment, when you don't get a chance to express yourself, you have a talent. You're able to do things, but they're not letting you sing. They're not letting you answer this question.
Right.
They're making you think that you're less than. And you want to release that anxiety, that anger, that frustration some type of way.
That's true.
And the outlet that you're given, so to speak, because they have so much control over what you do.
Right.
That creates a lot of tension and stuff. And like I said, if this is all by design. And until we get people, more people that look like us, that really want to teach black people and teach from the African perspective in the schools, it's not going to change. And that's what we need. We don't need to be bombarded with their way of thinking and doing things their way and then try to make that adjustment and do everything like them, just like us. Not these, like you said earlier about knowing, speaking French and I forgot what the other language was, but we don't speak our African tongue.
Right. Okay, I got to take a break. We're at the top of the hour. I want to come back, and I want to open up. I want to hear what some of our sisters got to say. Well, we need to hear from the womb, because this is their babies that are being killed and are dying in the streets. So what do they need to serve? Let's take a quick break, and I'm going to open up so that more of us can chime into this conversation.
Let me give you a word of the philosophy of reform. The whole history of the progress of human liberty shows that all concessions yet made to her august claims have been born of earnest struggle. The conflict has been exciting, agitating, all-absorbing, and for the time being, putting all other tumults to silence. It must do this, or it does nothing. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one. And it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, it never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or with both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress. In the light of these ideas, Negroes will be hunted at the North and held and flogged at the South, so long as they submit to these devilish outrages and make no resistance, either moral or physical. Men may not get all they pay for in this world, but they must certainly pay for all they get. If we ever get free from the oppressions and wrongs heaped upon us, we must pay for their removal. We must do this by labor, by suffering, by sacrifice, and if needs be, by our lives.
Good morning or evening, friends. Here's your friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to tears and I'm
is your time for an awakening media lineup. Monday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspective, with host Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, with host Brother Jihad Ahmed, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambom and Sister Nataki Kambom, 9 p.m. till 10 p.m., Conversation Reparations, first and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Melanin Live with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening, with creator of Time for an Awakening and host, Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk, with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, I'm sorry. I want to ask Sister Dee Dee. Sister Dee Dee, how do we implement the suggestion of Frederick Douglass in the quote that we just played at the break? How do you see that as a mother? You have a male child that you gave birth to. How do we put that in action from your perspective?
Good evening, family. I have two sons. My youngest son was incarcerated at a young age, and it's just so hard, Dr. Rogers, because even me at a young age, I didn't know a lot that was going on, like it's going on in the world, like I know now.
Right.
And my oldest son was just in some mess. He, you know, went down to Florida with his girlfriend. They were going, just looking for a new, you know, just a better way of life, or, you know, just something different.
Mm-hmm.
And my oldest son has, he's epilepsy. He sustained seizures from a beatdown he got on the South Side some years ago, maybe about 15 years ago. But anyway, he had seizures because of that now. Okay, to make a long story short, he was having a seizure. His girlfriend said she called the paramedics. They came. But when he come out of these seizures, sometimes he's kind of combative or whatever. So they called the police. The police came. They tased my son. He got up, ran in the house. He was just still disoriented. So I guess they broke out all the windows in their apartment and everything, finally kicked the door in, went in and got my son. This happened last year, May. So my son was in jail down there in Valladolid, Georgia, from May My young son went down and bailed him out. They tried to get my son, which a lot of black folks don't know about taking a plea deal. This is how they lock up a lot of our black men, too. So they came to my son and asked him, you know, to take a plea deal or whatever. And he said, no. He said, I'm not pleading to something I didn't do. He's supposed to have hit a cop, so they say. So they were holding him for that, giving him a felony. Now, this is my oldest son we're talking about. Don't even have a record, you know. Haven't been in trouble with the law. He was in jail once for a mistaken identity. He got out on that. But anyway, down there in Valdosta, Georgia, like I said, kept in jail for 9 months. Finally gave him a bail, told him he had a $30,000 bail. I'm like, these people is crazy. They claim he hit a cop in his ear, broke his eardrum. Then they turn around and say, oh, it was just some blood vessels broke. Now they didn't turn around and say he didn't broke somebody's nose or whatever. But I know they're lying. We know they're lying. But, and so they finally dropped his bail. They dropped his bail down to like $5,000 or something like that. Anyway, my youngest son went and got him out. But this is what really threw me for a loop. He went down, bailed him out. Now, my son has never even went to court yet on this mess. They turned around when he got bailed out, gave him a sheet of paper with 12 dates on it, like February 12th, March 12th, April 12th, this and that. He has to appear down there every month on the 12th to see when his court date is. Mm-hmm. Isn't that dirty? Now, he don't live there. He does not reside in Valdosta.
Well, has he tried to demand that they take another look at this situation and the case? I know a lot of times through the justice system, you have to have good lawyers and pay a lot of money for that. But
yes, that costs too. And then I failed to tell you, I apologize, but my son also suffers from mentally ill bipolar. Oh. We have a lot of, there's a lot of mentalness even in our families. A lot of us don't want to recognize the elephant in the room till he stomps on us. But there's a lot of mental illness for a lot of different reasons in our families. But anyway, with all of that, I called the DA to ask the DA, you know, why does he have to come down here like that for a whole year? He do not reside in Valdosta. And they said, well, he has to check that calendar. Otherwise, if he missed that court date, you know, we can put a warrant out for his arrest, come and get him, blase, skippy. So then another person told me, say, well, you can call down here and check. But, Doc, I'd be scared to call and check because they can easily say, oh, no, you didn't call. They can easily make up anything, and my son will be arrested and thrown in jail.
Right. So the demand and process that you're trying to do, you run into the brick wall, as you're saying.
Now we're trying to obtain a lawyer.
Yeah. Okay. Let me go over here and ask. Let me go ask Mr. Yon. Mr. Yon, is Frederick Douglass's suggestion a reality for us?
Is his suggestion a well? First of all, greetings, everybody.
Greetings.
Peace and love, family.
Greetings, sister.
And thank you, Sister Dee. Is it Dee Dee?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Always a pleasure to hear your voice.
Always, always. Same thing here. You're my sister, even though we never even met. But we know each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what's your question, Doc?
Is Frederick Douglass's statement that we just played at the top of the hour, is that realistic for us to put into place now, and can it be done?
No, you know what? Every time we talk about this, I get really, really pissed off.
Okay.
And I feel like we I can curse, right, Doc?
I'm sorry.
I can curse, right?
Yeah. No, you good?
Yeah. So we need to stop putting up with this shit. You know, we have to find a way out of this. So what I want to say, because, you know, there's so many examples of torture. I mean, we've got 400 years of torture to go through.
Sure have.
So in different phases, Jim Crow, integration, the Black Power movement, everything we've done has been taken down and destroyed. And if the enemy didn't destroy it, we destroyed it ourselves. So, you know, a lot of us are aware of this, but a lot of the masses of our people don't understand these things. And so they're just reacting, you know, every time something occurs. So this is what I was thinking, Doc, and everyone else. We have to understand that we're not dealing with normal human beings.
That's right.
We really do, because we keep trying to, like what Frederick Douglass was saying and others say, you got to vote and do this and do that. We're not dealing with normal humans.
Mm-hmm.
We simply not. These are psychopaths. These are people with a brain abnormality. And their way of life, their thinking, their culture is violence. That's their culture.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as with them, we can't get away from that. That is the reality. If we as a people really understood we can't stop a predator from being a predator, then that would take us closer to reality. Because as long as you're not living in reality, you cannot find a realistic solution. I have some ministers that I've worked with, and I love them so much. You know, but they just go and pray at the governmental plaza and whatnot. That's a damn waste of time. So, you know, I look at, and we all should look at, what actually worked for us.
Because
we've been tortured, like I said, forever.
That's the question we've got to answer. That's the one we've got to answer.
Right. So the Haitian Revolution worked. So we should study that very carefully. Every inch of that. Marcus Garvey, his movement worked. Because he did two things. I was looking at his biography recently. He instilled something in black people that we keep losing, which is a sense of pride and race esteem. We had self-pride, but we were proud of our people. We don't have that anymore. We fight like cats and dogs.
Yeah, we do. Each other. We fight each other.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So that has to be, everything that's been done to us has to be undone.
Right.
And guess who has to do that? We do.
Right.
Stop
right.
looking to the enemy to fix your problems. It's not going to happen. Their court systems are not going to do it.
Mm-mm.
You know, their voting, their education, none of this is going to do it. We have to implement our own solutions.
All right.
And the other thing, so understanding that we're not dealing with fully human beings, that would help us. And we're just not doing that. It's like we can't get it through our heads that this ain't your daddy, that paternalism that somebody talked about.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is a monster.
You got that right.
Yeah, so how do we deal with it? So, And we talk, you know, in this monstrous system that we're in, they deal with problems from a symptom-oriented perspective,
right?
And that's what we're doing. We're looking at the symptoms of being under the subjugation and the terrorism of a lunatic race. Now, the African way is to look at the root of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes to re-Africanizing our minds. We really have to look at the root of the problem, right? We're dealing with the two-headed monster. On the one hand, you got white pathology, and then on the second hand, you have menticide, which they cause in us. So if we focus on that and begin to organize, I hope I'm not all over the place because there's so much
no,
I want
no, that's good.
To say.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at these two realities, we didn't make ourselves sick. They made us sick. They made us sick just from being around them. We caught their nasty ass COVID, cold, all of the sickness we have, all their mental illness. We never had no damn bipolar disorder in Africa.
No.
We didn't have jails. Dr. Clark told us we didn't have jails. We didn't have old folks home with all of this stuff.
Right.
No.
We
no
got
cancer
sick from
in
being
Africa.
Around them. So we have to get away from them. You know what?
You're
I don't
fine.
Care what they offer you. How many millions of dollars? Get the hell away from them.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, say that, sister.
That's the bottom line. And the other thing is that they make, Doc, your introduction, you hit it on the head. Their initial plan was 40 acres and a mule. You know, they sent some of us to Liberia. But a lot of them said, just annihilate the niggas. Annihilate them. Yeah, get rid of them.
That's what they wanted to do. Yep.
That's what they're doing. It's just a very slow process.
That's right.
Right.
So we got to face that truth. They're not going. They're not going to change. They're slowly annihilating us.
Right.
And what you said about your son being in locked up, sister, you know, it breaks my heart because I hear that story all of the time from so many friends.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if we get back to what worked, Garvey was able to instill pride in the people that had been totally dehumanized, and he was able to organize us. Now we got to look at where he succeeded and where he failed.
Okay.
Look at where Haiti succeeded and where Haiti failed.
Yes.
And then we pick up these revolutions and we keep on moving. We pass them to our children. Mm-hmm. But one more, last thing, we've got to do this strategically. And we've got to do it amongst ourselves, because if Biden and Kamala Harris with her lying ass, if they said, and they're the incarceration administration, so let's be real clear.
Mm-hmm.
If they said, black people, you should have a national black dialogue, then we would jump up and do it.
Right. Exactly.
Now, if we said it on this show, which I've said many times, we need to have black national dialogue amongst ourselves so we can start to really go in deep into the root of this problem so we can root it out.
Right.
Yeah.
I like
that. If we said black people, come on, let's do it. We probably get 5% of our population.
I like that. You're right. Let me let me go over here to good brother Dr. Bridges, who is always gives us profound insight onto that. Dr. Bridges, let me start off by just asking you a question that I'd like for you to just deal with, and then you can go into what you want to say. But Douglas's comment, and again, this is all talk or stuff. It didn't happen. But does that make sense, what he was suggesting to us? Because I know you talk about recapturing the African mind, and that too has to be think tanks. How are you going to do that in this system? You know, like Sister Yan said, you're dealing with a different animal species. You're dealing with pure, natural, unadulterated evil.
Dealing with a beast.
Really are. That's what you're dealing with. So how do we deal with that, Dr. Bridges, historically? How was it done historically before? How did you do that?
Well, okay, you got about three questions. First of all, Frederick Douglass, that's the first question you asked. Frederick Douglass definitely had a good idea, even though it was oratorical, but he said something which is very, very, very important. And of that long statement, and that that part of it is when he said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will.
Right.
The waters, defecating agitation, and not plowing the crop, all that, a lot of that was all rhetorical. But the main part is power concedes nothing without a demand. And also, as a part of that statement, he said, too, which is very important, you must consistently and consciously and systematically agitate. He always said that, agitate.
Mm-hmm. He sure did.
And when you say agitate does not necessarily mean going to the Congress, but it could mean that, because we need to fight on all levels or go to the House of Representatives. But more so than that, in my classes, I used to talk about agitation in the classroom, which will tie right into what you said about the other brother said about us not, the policeman brother, not knowing ourselves. You have to begin to agitate and critically analyze, as the brother said, what we've been taught and these heroes that we've been given, and we have to work on our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be done by people who are in positions in the schools, all levels, elementary, high school, colleges, they have to begin to teach that way. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine and I were talking today, and we discussed how the system says, for example, in the academic arena, it says that you have academic freedom, and you can express yourself. But we have to see the hypocrisy in that, because we have several examples throughout history, in the past and present, about how when you express yourself, you will no longer be at that university. You know, you no longer have a job. Cornel West's situation right now is a good example of it.
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, so, but that's what has to happen. And the only way it can happen, and I'm tying in with Frederick Douglass and also with the policeman brother, and I'm also going back to what Sister Benicia said, and that is we have to begin to have our own, and to tie it into what Marcus Garvey was saying, independent schools, independent classes, our own research from an Afrocentric perspective. That's what we have to do. We have to step out of the as I said in my book, step out of that that systematic block of teaching and training that we've been told. We got to break the mold and come out of it. And that's what Garvey did. He broke the mold and began to talk about Africa as opposed to talking about Scotland and France. He started talking about Kenya and Mozambique and Liberia. And you have to begin to get rid of all that stuff. And Garvey did it through his movement, and tying in again to what another one of your, Sister Peniswa said, and that is, we have to begin to have our own right. And think for ourselves, and that's the only way we're going to be able to do it, because it's going to be very difficult to do it within the system.
Well, let me ask you, who started that? Who's responsible for getting that moving? How do you see that? Okay, I like what you said, and I agree with you 100%. What is the step for that? Who makes that step? Who does
it? When you say who does?
Who actually begins to map that plan out and do it? You know, and I'm going by history, because historically, you know, you get a like that movie said, you get a Messiah, you get a Fred Hampton. You get a Malcolm X, and you'll get somebody like that to come up, and they start pulling these ideas together.
Or Marcus Garvey. I see what you're saying now, right?
Yeah. So who does that?
And they begin to do it.
Right.
And as I was talking to somebody else too, say in terms of right now in Black America, on a level such as a Garvey or a Malcolm, as you said, or even a national speaker like Frederick Douglass, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I cannot think of anybody out there on a national level who is pushing and who's vocal and who is in the. I can't think of anybody who's doing that now. You're right, Bill.
You're right. That's right. Exactly.
Because
Minister Farrakhan has gotten older. He's older. You know, he's going to be limit how he can, what he has to do. But, I mean, he's still vocal.
But not nearly what he used to be. You're right. But he's not right. And other than Minister Farrakhan, and like you said, Malcolm's gone. King is not on the scene. Kwame Ture Stokes, he's gone. Huey is gone. But, and you know, that's a good point you bring up. That might be a good discussion for one night. There's really nobody on the national, because other people are just what I call public intellectuals, like Cornel West and Michael Eric Dyson, people like that. But you're right. There's nobody doing it. So what we have to do, I believe, is do it on, like we're doing, do it on our small, minute, lower levels, and try to get to people as much as possible.
I agree.
For example, today I saw something, and they were talking about brothers written a book. And he was doing something at C.C. Spaulding School, and they showed the background of a bulletin board at Spaulding. And on the background of the bulletin board at Spaulding Elementary School, which is a predominantly Black school, there's a picture of a Superman, some superhero. So the people who are in positions in these classrooms, some of these teachers really just need to be pulled out and whipped if they don't get it together and start teaching from a Black perspective. And that's exactly where it needs to be done, because they're not doing that. And I was just surprised. I said, now all this stuff that's going on, they got a Superman on the bulletin board, at a black school. Not a black hero, not a Malcolm, not a King, not even nothing.
I know.
You see, so, it really has to be, the best we can do, I think, at this point, is to do it on the levels that we're on. And I think really the time is now, you know, for it to be done, because, you know, people are open. People are open to it now. And the brother mentioned, too, about the killing. And nobody has, I haven't had anybody say anything about the one I tuned in late out in Aurora, Colorado, that happened a couple of days ago.
Oh, no.
The young 26-year-old brother that died about 6 days later after he suffocated and he fainted, stopped for nothing. He was coming from work, and they stopped him.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you all may have talked about it, but I missed it. But what I'm saying, it's still going on.
It sure
it's
is.
Still going on.
Still going on.
And then one point I want to make, too, and that is that we have to fight on all levels. There has to be some people in the classroom. There has to be some people, like I said, in politics. There's got to be some brothers who keep their mouth closed and who take care of business when one of ours get killed, like out in California.
Yeah.
We have to. There's a need for that arm of the struggle also.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. Let me go over here. Now, Brother Timothy, you live in a city where the police went into a community and blew the damn house up.
Yeah, definitely.
They blew the whole damn thing up. Brother Timothy, what's going on? Is Philadelphia fighting stuff like that?
Yes, brother. I'm going to tell you this, brother. I'm happy that we're talking about the subject. I'm going to start it like this. Mm-hmm. That in the 80s, Brother Eileen and the Washington Moss, he came up with the concept of the dope busters, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we adopted it in all the temples in the United States of America. And we liked what they did in D.C. They would go to the drug dealers and talk to them, bring them into the temple.
Mayfair Mansion, Mayfair.
Exactly, exactly. The programs we were doing and things of that nature. Well, Philadelphia, we adopted it, right? And when I never forget this, man. The nation put this will in us. You know, sometimes the ministers get on that roster, man, and put something in you. You know what I'm saying? You want to choke a brick and drown water for the nation. It's just like that. No lie. Listen, right? One of the absolute projects, right? They were selling drugs like they had a pharmacy. And we had an army now. I ain't saying we had two people. You know, when the nation come, you got 25 brothers with bow ties on, man. Half of them been in and out of prison, college, whatever. You know, they know the streets. We went up to the brothers, right, to talk to them. Next thing I know, brothers from tipping up to the shotgun out of his hand. I said, wow. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And the brothers just, like, backed up. Because they saw all these brothers, right, they look at us as being clean. They didn't know that we were, you know, that put that will in you there. It was necessary. We were going to slow down. Now, here's the thing. They got the white man's dope selling it. And you know, they're out of order in the projects with poison. And guess what? We were the best to have in their corner because we didn't come there to hurt nobody. Mm-hmm. We come to stop the BS. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So at that point, they was like in a mental arrest. And let me tell you something. So were we, because I mean, we never thought the brothers were snatched it out of his hand. We said, wow. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So we talked. You know what I'm saying? Come to the temple number 12, and we got programs going on. And that was an interesting thing. It made the paper. I'll never forget that. So listen to this. I'm telling you this for a reason. That was in the 80s. But I'm going to tell you something. What's going on now? I'm older now. Oh, man, that was some years ago. And what I see today is interesting. I talked to Dr. Rogers, and I always call him, ask him about what the project, what programs, what's the subject, who's coming on. So I told him that. It was a guy, 16 years old, went into a bowling alley on the outside of Philadelphia called Norristown.
Mm-hmm.
Went into the bowling alley and shot five people. One man was 70 years old. I have a question for y'all people. What is a young guy 16 years old doing with a 45? Now, I mean, come on, man. It's like a cannon, isn't it? I mean, you got a 45, right? He shoots five people, and one of the men, 70 years old, right? He leaves out of the bowling alley, and they can't find him. Listen to this. Tell you how unprofessional he is and doesn't know what he's doing. I'm pretty sure he knows how to shoot the gun. He dropped the cell phone. They picked the cell phone up. He got a picture of himself with the 45 in the picture. Man, this is different, Dr. Rogers.
Yeah.
This is Sister Bruce. This is different, Brother Bruce Bridges. This is, man, I mean, come on, man. This is like, and we could deal with the projects thing because they were selling poison to each other like they had a pharmacy. These young teenagers, the week before that, there's this bus station, a main bus station, where people go to different parts of the cities to go to work. They go in a store, man, find them and shoot out in a store in daylight. I mean, I know white supremacy, and I grew up with Gunsmoke and Untouchables and all that kind of stuff. You know, and I'm long ranging with guns. But this is some stuff. This is some stuff, man. And somebody said, "What's the video games?" Well, I mean, I'm trying to say, I know it's a sickness, and she's right, Sister Benice, about the white supremacy and how we're connected and how we need to get away from these people. But right now, man and woman, we got to know how to unleash this beast in them in order to free ourselves. I mean, this is 6 years old, man. Where did he get a foot? That's a cannon, ain't it?
Right.
God, I remember I saw the movie Patton had 245s on his waist. 45, man, that's some artillery there, bro.
Brother Timothy, I want to go over here and grab one more person. I definitely want to hear from him. Reverend Lewis, are you there? Reverend Greg Lewis, are you there? Pastor Lewis? Okay, he's not there. I wanted to ask him. He represents the Black Church. Brother Lush, what do you think? You come out of a city that's real. It was over the years in the civil rights movement, violent. I mean, white folks were really crazy in Montgomery. What do you think is the way that we can address this in our community? I like your rationale sometimes, and, you know, your critical thinking.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Dr. Rogers. Can the master's tools ever dismantle the master's house?
All right.
Can the master's tools ever dismantle the master's house? You know, I've heard a lot this evening, and wow, it's deep. It's so deep, I think, Doc Rogers, that it has gotten to the point where one literally, as well as figuratively, has to take care of one's self.
Yes.
You need to be able to get back home to your family. Brother Horace, do you hear me?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
I think that's something that the boys in blue, quote unquote, kind of say to themselves at the end of the meetings, that they need to get back to their families. And so they're going to do whatever it's going to take to save their own selves. And I don't know too much about the snitching thing, and, don't know too much about, I think about William O'Neill in the movie with Fred Hampton, and maybe if he went the left instead of going right, would we have had the kind of type of issues, right? He knew what he done. He knew what he done did was not quite right. He knew that. He knew that. And so sometimes I wonder, do we ever put ourselves in the frame of mind that, you know something? I got to get back home to my and save myself. If that means I have to kind of bob and weave whatever the situation is, I will do just that for the 8 hours or 10 hours or whatever number to ensure my own safety and the safety of my family. And so it's hard, I think, for us because we are not only representative of our own selves, our own family, but we're also Black people
right.
In general. And so it's boy, to navigate through all of that is really kind of tough.
It is frustrating. So, it is.
It really is.
It is.
And so,
very frustrating.
Can the master's tools dismantle the master's house? To me, it kind of says, doesn't matter how well versed you may be in the skill of masonry or the skill of working with your hands, no matter what you have, it's all going to be all for naught. So, therefore, one must save oneself.
All right.
That's all I have to offer.
Thank you. You know, I think about the decision, if it's true. Don't know sometimes, but at least according to what the media says, if it's true, Stevie Wonder has a great idea. And
yeah.
I think that maybe that's something we need to take a look at. You know, I mean, we've been talking about it before, but, you know, we don't have Stevie's money that we can do and do that, but we need to find some way to look at a plan similar to that. That has to be put on the table. I'm not going to say that's what we do. But I think that has a place at the table as well to discuss that. We have a caller from Henderson, North Carolina. I don't know if you want to say something or you just listen. Caller, would you like to say something?
Yes. Greetings, everyone.
Greetings.
All
greetings.
The family.
Greetings.
I have just a few things to say. Number one, I was at University of Olaife in Nigeria in 1971. And I'm appalled that I didn't hear a lot of faith by everyone in regards to the mission of a very beautiful, the most powerful black man on the planet. I'm appalled, you know, as if he's pushed to the side. This man, Mr. Farrakhan, has brought millions of people out and can do it today. When I was in Nigeria, the reason why I said that was that I was into the Pan-Africanism. I was like, oh, say, this is the only way we can come back together with our people. But do you know that all I heard when I was there was the brothers would tell me in debating at the university was that, brothers, don't bring me nothing but the teachers of the honorable Elijah Muhammad. He's the only one that's bringing industry, jobs, businesses, education, dignity to our people. We don't see I'm not hearing the pure quality or the value in this conversation of what this man or the nation of the honorable Elijah Muhammad, who manifested Malcolm, Muhammad Ali, we don't see the crust that God has brought something to us. We are looking as if like, oh, where is it? What is it coming from? What are we going to do next? It's already here. We don't realize it. We have to take a close examination that God has put something in our midst, and we're just not looking at it. Because of whatever frivolous reasons there are, I'm appalled that we're not putting a lot of value. Listen, I believe in cultural revolution. I was the director of the Mufundi Cultural Institute in Watt, which was founded by Malani Karinga, Imam Abdul Rahman, which the word Mufundi means craftsman. I was director of that for a while. And while I was there, I worked with many of the gang brothers throughout all of L.A., Crips, Baru, Bishop, you name them. I worked with the leaders, Tookie Williams. I knew all of them. And all of them were saying, man, the only thing that can really help us that nation is Islam, but I got a problem. I don't want to deal with that pork. See, we have to, I'm going to leave that pork. So those are little things that in order for us to get freedom, that we're going to have to sacrifice and look deeply to see that, yes, Marcus Garvey was a beautiful person. I also had a chance of meeting a man who was one of his lieutenants in Phoenix, Arizona, when I worked there for a while.
Right.
He was one of his lieutenants, and he said, brother, he said, Marcus had a great program, but what happened was, when they were going back and forth, was that when they went over there, men and the brothers were having the same disease of ripping off the people, the same cultural disease
that was transplanted
into our souls. And how does that say, hey, man, you got to get these people out of here. They're corrupting my people. So the underlying of Muhammad, the nation of Islam, has purified is purifying our people with dignity. When I was over there with General Rawlings, 40th anniversary in Ghana, I was there to witness men and the king and throughout the villages of Ghana coming I have it on videotape. I videotaped it coming into the palace there where the minister was saying, bowing down, bearing gifts. These kids didn't have to do this. They had gold all over their bodies, wrapped around their arms, their staff made out of solid gold. But they're bowing down to a man because they recognize something in this man that we don't. Around the world, they see who the quality of this man. I'm not saying we all have become a Muslim, but look at what this man has brought to the table, is bringing to the table. He's a prototype.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we have a solution to the problem. Negative Islam is just only a prototype which we all can go about in our churches, institutions, and put down and observe our diet. I had a sister, or had a sister. Her name was Florence Griffith Joyner, Flojo. That was my baby sister.
Yes, yes.
What made her come across and do what she did was I took her off of pork. She used to love it. We all did. But when she got off that pork, she thanked me. She said, that made me faster, made me feel stronger, made me pure, think quality. We have to look at our diet. That's another very important factor.
No doubt about it. No doubt. Yeah, it's a plethora of things that really face us like that. You're right. And I agree.
I just had to expound on that, brother. I don't
think. No, that's good. No, I clearly support what you're saying. That's why from time to time we try to bring on brothers and sisters from the nation. We were supposed to have Brother Wesley Muhammad on a couple of weeks ago. He had to cancel. He had something coming up. We do have him coming on again. And try to hear from him what he's saying to do. And we had Brother Dennis Muhammad on not too long ago. And Brother Dennis.
I know both of them brothers. Yes,
yeah.
Sir. I understand.
So we do. I hear you. The nation has clearly presented itself as an example of some of the things that we have to do. So I'm right with you with that. Okay, we've got about 3 minutes to go. I want to ask our sister Edwards, I see if she's just logged in, if she would just want to give us an announcement about the program. I think it's a very good presentation that's going to be done on Friday evening, and what she's trying to do with her organization, the Art of Health, and some of the things that she did outside of her art gallery that she owns. So, Sister Edwards, you want to just mention the date and time, and I know that the original link you sent out was a PDF, so no one can go on and connect to anything. So, you might want to tell them how they can get that link.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Rogers, and good evening to everyone. Well, the link, it is on the information is contained on the flyer, correct, Dr. Rogers?
Yeah, it's on that flyer, but it doesn't allow you to link on. I had a person that called me today to say they were testing it out and they could not, you know, obviously by it being a PDF, they were not able to do that.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, I'll look into that and then I'll resend it. But the information is there, and I think if you copy and paste it onto your Zoom page, if you put the identification number for the meeting, and then it also has the passcode. So
okay.
I think you'll be able to access it that way instead of just hitting the flyer and then the flyer, bringing you right to the Zoom channel.
Okay.
So, but anyway, I'll look into that with my assistant and see if we can, better make that happen. But yes, we're going to be reading, or you're going to be presenting from the book, The Miseducation of the Negro, by Dr. Carter Woods, and I think it's important because, you know, we celebrate Black History Month, and I think it's important that we recognize a man and his association, his hard work, who helped bring it to fruition, who oftentimes, you know, we overlook that aspect. And so there's a lot of knowledge and wisdom in his teachings, and we're just going to look at some of that, revisit it, in hopes that we can further this legacy of this great individual that was amongst us, and that we can find some more inspiration for ourselves and for our children and others, and help towards building our community.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us tonight. This has been a wonderful discussion. It's an ongoing discussion. We will continue to talk about this, and so we appreciate you. I'm just thinking that we just scratched the surface, but as Brother Lush said, we gotta dig deep on this one, because this is really a very powerful situation that's destroying our community, and it's destroying us if we don't, and the future generation coming behind us, and we have an obligation to save that. So let's think about that. We'll be here next Tuesday evening, 7 o'clock, right here at the Black Reality Think Tank. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful, wonderful week.